Hi, I'm Andre Greenwald. I head up public policy at VIA. Welcome to The Dispatch, a new podcast series in which we interview leaders in transportation. I'm really excited to be joined today by Beth Osborne, the director for Transportation for America, and one of our country's leading voices on transportation policy. I got to know Beth in our previous gigs working together in the Obama administration, where Beth was a senior appointee at the Department of Transportation. Thank you so much for joining us today, Beth.
Thanks for inviting me.
So for those listening who may be unfamiliar with Transportation for America, can you tell us a little bit about your work and your organization's work?
Sure. Transportation for America is a national nonprofit focused on creating a transportation system that connects people to jobs and services through multiple modes of travel, no matter their financial means or physical ability. We do our work through development of policy and policy advocacy. We do direct technical assistance with those that want to work towards our mission. And we do research and analysis about how the current system is working or often is not working in meeting our objectives.
Great. So I've heard you speak several times on panels at conferences, and you have a quote that I love about when you were younger and in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, I believe, and I'm paraphrasing here. You can correct me if I get this a bit wrong, but say something to the effect of that you couldn't get a job because you didn't have a car, and you couldn't get a car because you didn't have a job. Can you talk a little bit about what you think that says for you about our transportation system and how it impacted your career in transportation policy and advocacy?
Yeah, I was in law school at the time. Don't let your loved ones go to law school, but that's for a different podcast. And I needed some money to help pay my bills. And every time I looked for a job, I really struggled to find one that I could get to either with transit, walking, or biking. I tried biking a few times, and it was perilous. It was terrifying. But if you ask Baton Rouge leaders, people, quote, choose not to ride their bike. I gave up on that after several near-death experiences, and eventually I had to give up on finding a job because I couldn't get to anyone that I was qualified for, but I couldn't afford to buy a car because I didn't have a job. And it was an eye-opening experience for me. I did not grow up poor. I grew up firmly in the middle class, really had everything I needed all through my life, had a lot of support and financial support from my parents, who eventually went out and bought me a used car to fix this problem. And that's frankly not something a lot of people out there can do. And it was just a very clear message to me that if I could not pay the cover charge to enter the economy, that my talents and my labor were unwelcome and unneeded. And I think not only is that a terrible message to send, it's a terrible economic structure. We want everyone who can work to work. We want everyone certainly who wants to and wants desperately to work to be able to work. And it is wasteful to have people that want to work on one side of town and people who have jobs that they want to fill on another side of town, and people stay unemployed on one side and jobs stay open on the other side because we haven't made the transportation connections suitable for those that can't afford a $15,000 to $20,000 gadget.
Yeah, and I'm sure you would agree that we have a lot of work to do at the federal, state, and local level to address those shortcomings of our transportation, which you described, which continue to persist today and will be even, perhaps things that are even more important to address as we emerge from COVID eventually. I guess on the federal front, which I know that T for America is particularly active in, and you personally have been at the forefront of for many years now on the federal policy front. Can you talk a little bit about your organization's advocacy on what the next major transportation bill should do to address some of those issues that you just talked about and others, and the key principles that you all have highlighted as an organization for Congress and for the administration?
Yeah, thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it. We are about a year ago, actually a little bit over a year ago now, we revisited what had become, kind of the prevailing knowledge and belief about how you impact transportation policy. The general belief for the last 20, 30 years was if you fought for more funding for the overall program, that put you in a position to be invited to the main table where the decisions were made, to influence how that money would be spent. What I found really happened was we would distribute pieces of the pie. Everyone would fight for a bigger pie. The overwhelming majority of it would go to create more of the problem that those of us trying to change things were trying to fix, but we'd be bought off with some tiny pot of money to, you know, scratch at the surface. So, you know, here is your program to retrofit dangerous streets for our most vulnerable users, those walking and biking. We'll give you $1 billion nationwide to do that while we spend $45 billion to continue to make it more dangerous. And I just, frankly, I don't have the patience for that. I just don't have the temperament for that kind of ineffectual deal making. And I can only lose the same way so many times before I give up on that strategy. And I wore out on the losing. And I wore out on the idea that I was winning when it was clear I was losing. So we decided to change our tack, and we pulled a lot of partners in, both some of our members to our organization and then just those that we work with a lot. And we hammered out what our principles for the next reform bill should be. And one of the principles was we're not in favor of more funding for this program, full stop. In fact, we're not in favor of the current money this program is getting. We'd like to see this program get no money. Even though there's a little bit in it for the things we like, it's whitewashing over, you know, tons and tons of money for things that we think are undermining people's ability to get work and get to the things they need and be safe and, you know, protect communities and the environment. So we laid out what we wanted to see. We limited it to three principles because I believe that's really, it's the ideal number. Everyone can remember three. And for do-gooders like us, it's hard to limit ourselves to three, but we got there. And so we focused on taking care of our existing infrastructure before you build new infrastructure that you can't afford to maintain. We call that fix it first. But it's not enough just to fix our current system, because our current system has a lot of flaws in it. So that's where the second two principles come from, to make it better. We want to focus on safety, but not just this amorphous concept of safety. One of the biggest causes of crashes and fatalities on a roadway is that we encourage very high speeds in places where that's completely inappropriate. On our interstates and our highways, where there's no development along the side of it, and we limit the number of places people can get on or off, high speed makes sense. But on our local roads and what we call our arterials, which are usually your big main roads, it doesn't make sense. There are driveways, there are people, and crashes become more frequent and very, very dangerous, as my colleagues at the National Complete Streets Coalition pointed out in their report called Dangerous by Design. And so we want to focus on safety over speed, which sounds like it makes sense, but in our system, speed is the purpose for our building and our design. And so we want to flip the paradigm. And the third is to organize the program around the concept of providing strong access to jobs and other necessities, whether it's grocery, medical care, childcare, education, banks, that we wanted people to be able to reach those things that they need, whether they have a car or not. And there are ways to measure that now that didn't exist before about 10 years ago. We want to deploy that to this work so that we know what are the types of transportation investments that make sure everyone has access to employment, whether they're driving there or they're getting there by transit or bike or pedestrian travel. So it's fix it first, safety over speed, access to jobs and services.
Sounds like common sense, right? But quite different from how money is distributed today.
Yeah, our current system, I will say, it operates, I wish I were exaggerating and making fun to make a point, but it is build whatever you want, whether you can afford to maintain it or not. And feel free to build new while you're not maintaining your existing system, which many states do. It is speed over safety. And it is access to the things you need only if you have enough money for everybody over 60 in your household to have their own car.
I just wanted to dive in a little bit more on the third point you mentioned, access to jobs and services. And you said that we have methods now to measure this in a way that we did not before. So two questions. One, is access to jobs and services any component of how federal funding is distributed today on the transportation front? And two, can you just talk a little bit more about, you know, what you think the best way to actually measure that is?
Yeah, we have had minor programs that have titles like that. There used to be a jobs access and reverse commute program that was used for a whole jumble of things for those who were, you know, in a place that had no transit service at all. There was a program to buy them cars, which is, I have to say, not even the biggest expense. It's the operation of the vehicle that can really harm folks. So when you read those articles about people coming together and buying someone a car, they never follow up to see if the person can afford to maintain it, and they almost never can. But you know, that's what we had available to us, and the program was small. The rest of the program really doesn't, but there's a fascinating history here where if you look back at the early days of the highway program, there's a lot of academic articles written about the best way to determine whether or not the program is operating well and our expenditures are doing what we want is to look at access to jobs. At the time, though, to measure every potential trip to every potential job in your region from every single household just by car, forget the other modes, would have required work by hand. And it would be extremely expensive to gather the information, to calculate the data. It would have been very person intensive. And by the time you'd done the calculations, they would have become old. So we looked for a proxy just for our lack of data and technical ability 70 years ago, which is understandable. And what they did was say, we were building interstates for cars, so they were focused on the car, and they said, well, we can assume that if we clear up a bottleneck on your way, that we've probably made your trip faster. A perfectly valid and fair hypothesis. The problem in transportation is we test our hypotheses, but we never go back to revisit them and see if they really warrant a truth theory status. We just stick with the hypothesis in spite of all evidence that it's wrong. So what we did was we cleared bottleneck after bottleneck, but the way we did it was we cut off other trips. So to make a trip through your community faster, we made it impossible to get across the corridor. We got rid of intersections and crossings. We made it unsafe to cross the street on foot at all. Like I said, many places you couldn't cross in a car. So now you have to go far out of your way to find the crossing and come back. But the deal was we made that cross, that through trip faster, sort of. And so we just ignored the other side of it. We also did things that in continually building outwards, we made people's overall trips so much longer that the time savings was lost in the length of the additional trip. And we don't measure the trip. We only measure between two observed locations. So basically, in kind of a bizarre extreme of the measure, at this point, if you travel in circles and never stop, but you're going at speed, that's an A+ in transportation. But if you get where you're going and stop and go traffic in 5 minutes, that's an F that requires tens of millions of dollars of intervention, much of which would involve getting rid of all the economic activity in the world that's blocking your path. So we started talking and working with a lot of engineers through our technical assistance. And frankly, a whole bunch of them said, I want to do what you're talking about, but it's qualitative. And I'm an engineer. You can't engineer to something you kind of know when you see. And they were right. It was really, really true. And so we started working with those that wanted to change that with some real help from the state of Virginia that put some money into finding a better way to measure things. They were told by their state legislature unanimously to measure access to jobs. And so we decided to crack the code. And we use GIS that has the map. You can buy a GIS overlay that has all important destinations, including groceries and jobs. And it's what goes into your Google map that you have in your phone or your Apple map. You do is through cloud computing, you do measure every single job from every single census tract. You know, to those jobs, you use the transit data feed called GTFS to measure all the transit trips. And we have some ways to determine whether or not something is truly walkable and bikeable, which tends to come down to the speed of the roadway, almost more than the infrastructure that's really there. So we can tell you exactly how many jobs people can reach within a particular period of time, by all modes of travel. And we've had a great response. People are super excited about it. We've got a bunch of states that are looking at ways to use it. Virginia's used it pretty actively for the past 6 years. A bunch of metropolitan planning organizations that are looking at using it or using it already. And we've gotten the House to put it in their new bill. So I think that what's interesting is how much excitement there is around this, no matter what type of state or region you're talking about, no matter the political leadership, everyone gets why measuring access to jobs is a lot better than measuring whether or not one little strip of roadway is operating the way you want.
Great. You mentioned the House bill. I was wondering if you could just tell us sort of at a high level how you think the recently passed large transportation bill by the House, how it does on those three principles that you all have been advocating for.
Yeah, it's definitely the best thing we've seen come out of Congress. It's not the way I would have written it. And I think there's still a problem in that highways are getting a ton more money than other modes. But the way the highway money is being spent is far superior to our existing program, and certainly better than the Senate bill, which really just puts more money into an existing ineffectual and damaging program. In spite of the Democrats and Republicans there, you know, cheering its bipartisanship over a bad bill is something to be ashamed of, not excited about. And they don't seem to recognize that. The House bill, however, really pushes some boundaries. And there is some strong fix-it-first language. You have to show that you're making progress and maintaining your existing infrastructure before you're allowed to add on. When you do add on, thanks to a bipartisan amendment by Representative Garcia of Chicago and Representative Gallagher of Wisconsin, you have to have a plan for maintaining the thing you're building. Again, I know that doesn't sound radical in this program. That is shocking. We've never asked for that. We asked for that in transit. We do not ask for that on the highway side. They put a ton of language and focus on addressing safety for vulnerable users. They have broad-based improvements in terms of funding for retrofits, but they also really get into the weeds on some of the technical things that create the lack of safety. One, the way we set speed limits. Right now, if you do what we call a speed study on a roadway and find that more than 15% of those driving on the roadway are breaking the speed limit, you raise the speed limit. So we reward bad behavior in the way we design our roadways. If enough people speed, we just let everybody speed. And actually, the National Association of City Transportation officials just put out a guide on looking at safety first rather than a speed-based system for setting speed limits. But the House bill gets all the way into that detail and then the big, broad concept of funding the retrofits too. And on access to jobs and services, they set a performance measure in this area and put some real teeth to it. So there's some really exciting things in this bill that is no easy thing to take on, and I have to say that the House writers were really engaged and really enthused.
Great. How do you see public transportation changing as we emerge from the COVID-19 pandemic? And curious in terms of the future of public transit and transportation, what you see as the potential role of on-demand public transit and other innovations in the space?
So I know that this is a hard answer for a lot of us in transportation to take, but we are a means to an end and not an end to our into ourselves. So we have to really believe and understand that, and I don't think most of us do. So the real question is, what is going to happen with the structure of the economy? And once we start to understand that, how are we going to serve it, not how we're going to serve ourselves? And I think, unfortunately, transportation rarely truly embodies that, or transportation planners and implementers. So I'm looking at, you know, how many people are going to continue to telework after we get out of this. So much of our transportation system is focused on the peak travel, the rush hour trip, in spite of the fact that it's only 20% of people's trips. 80% of our travel is for other things than work. Our work trip tends to be longer, so it's 70% of our actual miles. But one thing that I wonder is if the transportation system doesn't start to finally focus on the majority of our trips. Maybe transit, maybe on demand, maybe all of these services start to orient, and I think on demand is particularly well positioned for this, for helping people go to shorter distance trips closer to home. I'd like to see both ride hailing and transit be better at trip chaining, because that's what people do. They want to run a whole bunch of errands at once. They don't go home to the grocery, back home to the bank and back, home to school and back. Like they do that in a trip. So how can ride hailing and transit do that better? If we are not all traveling to work at the same time, and you don't need a huge reduction for it to become free flowing, can we stop this never-ending attempt to expand the roadway forever? Can we acknowledge, like our congestion con report shows, that the more you expand the roadways, the worse traffic gets, because that has been the only outcome for any place ever? Can we really start thinking about operations in general of both the highways and transit? That would be great. But I think we need to get ready for a huge restructuring of everything we know. There's a lot of evidence that people have come to accept teleworking and like it, that 30 to 40% of those doing it now say they'd like to do it permanently forever, and that a huge percentage more would like to do it at least sometimes. That might relieve us of a ton of transportation servicing. And while that will have implications, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because it's not our job to force people to travel. It's our job to serve people when they need to.
Great. Well, this has been fantastic. Every time we talk, I learn something new, and today was no exception. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. Thank you to everyone who has listened to this. I encourage you to check out other episodes of our interviews with transit leaders around the world. Have a great day, and thank you so much, Beth.
Thank you.